Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn and Anna Mateo. Later, we will present the next part in our series on America's national parks. But first, American drug maker Moderna said Monday that its experimental COVID-19 vaccine produced antibodies in a small group of healthy people in an early trial. The company said 8 people who received 2 small amounts of its vaccine developed antibodies similar to those developed by people who have recovered from the disease. The U.S. National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases led the experiment, also called a trial. It involved 45 volunteers who received 1 or 2 shots of differing amounts of the vaccine. Tal Zaks is the chief medical officer at Moderna. Based on early results of the trial, he said the vaccine has the potential to prevent COVID-19 disease. He also said the company now can better choose the vaccine amount needed for further experiments. The testing involved 3 different amounts. Zach said the 2 smaller amounts of vaccine seem safe, and the larger amount caused some short-term side effects. 3 study subjects developed flu-like conditions following a second shot of the large dose. Moderna said it plans to drop that amount for the next part of the trial. Amesh Adalja is an infectious disease expert at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security, who was not involved in the study. He told Reuters that the findings are meaningful, but noted that they come from only 8 people. "It was designed for safety, not for efficacy," he said. Moderna has been permitted to start a second part of human testing that will involve several hundreds of people. In April, the U.S. government gave the company $483 million for vaccine development. Last week, U.S. officials gave the vaccine special recognition to help speed the process for approval. Stefan Bonsell, chief executive officer of Moderna, said the company is hoping to start part 3 of the study in July. The company will try to find the lowest amount of vaccine necessary to protect people. In May, Moderna and the biotechnology company Lonza agreed to work together over the next 10 years to make a vaccine. The partnership could lead to the manufacture of 1 billion COVID-19 vaccine treatments a year. There are currently no approved treatments or vaccines for COVID-19. Almost 4.8 million people are confirmed to have had the virus. It is known to have killed about 320,000. However, experts think the numbers may be underreported. The World Health Organization has listed more than 100 efforts to develop effective treatments and vaccines for the coronavirus. The list includes clinical trials in China, at the University of Oxford, and with American drug makers Pfizer, Inovio, and Moderna. Experts predict a safe and effective vaccine could take 12 to 18 months to develop. The results of Moderna's early trial have not been published. But the news lifted the company's stock prices and spread hope that a solution against the infectious disease might be close.
A drop in tourism during the coronavirus crisis is making it more difficult for some organizations to protect threatened wildlife in Africa. Wildlife officials fear poaching activity will rise because the collapse of the travel industry leaves less money for guarding animals. In Kenya, the Olpaheta Conservancy Project is home to more than 130 black rhinos. It forms the single largest group of the animals in East and Central Africa. "We are more alert because maybe more poachers will use this time to come in to poach," said John Tekeles. He is a guard at the Olpaheta Conservancy. His comments were reported by the Associated Press. African rhinos have long been under threat from poachers who kill them for their horns. The illegal trade is fueled by the belief, in some cultures, that the horns have medicinal value, which has not been proven by science. The number of black rhinos in Africa has been slowly increasing. But a report in March by the International Union for Conservation of Nature, IUCN, said it still considered the animals critically endangered. In part, the organization credits the comeback of the rhinos to effective law enforcement. However, Olpaheta's director, Richard Vigna, said enforcement measures are very costly. He said he spends about $10,000 each year for every rhino to pay for the protection. "In our case, that comes to close to $2 million a year," Vigna told the AP. "In the time of COVID, when tourism has completely stopped, where most of our revenue comes from tourism, it's a complete disaster." COVID-19 is the disease caused by the coronavirus. The Conservancy expects to lose $3 to $4 million this year. Vigna said the loss severely limits the group's ability to protect the rhinos. Wildlife activists across Africa are now waiting to see how poachers will react to the current situation and whether more rare wildlife will be killed. Poaching of African rhinos had been decreasing in recent years, the IUCN reported. The group said there were 892 acts of poaching in 2018, down from a high of 1,349 in 2015. The IUCN said the population of black rhinos grew at a yearly rate of 2.5% between 2012 and 2018. Now there are more than 5,600 animals. That growth was predicted to continue over the next 5 years, the environmental group said. I'm Brian Lynn.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. In springtime, many Americans take on a major project, cleaning their homes from top to bottom. We often call this kind of work spring cleaning. Part of spring cleaning often involves clearing out clutter. We do away with things we no longer need, like old magazines, toys from our childhood, collections of things we no longer collect. If we are to believe the many stories on Marie Kondo, the queen of clean, clutter adds unnecessary stress to our lives. Clutter is holding us back from our dreams and goals. But is it? To answer this question, I spoke with an expert on the subject, Sabine Kastner of Princeton University. She has been studying how the brain processes clutter for 20 years. From the start of our interview, Professor Kastner wants to make two things clear. Not all clutter is bad, and our brains can deal with it. The media, Kastner says, often writes about clutter in a very simple black and white way. Clutter affects the mind, and we need to clear it out. But Kastner says it is much more complex than that. For starters, she says, our brains are designed to deal with clutter.
Clutter is all around us all the time as soon as we are opening our eyes. And the fact that we do not perceive it as that just speaks to the, you know, to this enormous capability that we have to deal with it.
Kastner uses a Christmas tree as an example. When we see a Christmas tree, we know what it is, a sign of the winter holiday season. We do not need to see each separate item hanging on the tree to understand this. Kastner says very early in the development of our eyesight, we begin to group objects that we see. This helps us to structure our environment. She explains that it helps us sort out anything that is not necessary.
The attention system in our brain actually likes clutter because that is what it's used to. And it is using this cluttered environment to make meaningful selections from it.
When we talk about clutter and how best our brains perform around it, Kastner says there is not a one-size-fits-all solution. The idea that an uncluttered workplace is better, she says, is not universally true. Kastner says some people need to see their work. If something is carefully put away, to them it does not exist anymore. Out of sight, out of mind. For other people, objects can stimulate their creativity and give them ideas.
Then there are other people who actually like that clutter, and they, you know, clutter the environment because it actually helps them. It's almost like stimulating their brain, to do something.
However, other people are unable to work in a cluttered environment. Kastner notes that some people may get distracted by having lots of things around them. These people may need more organization and less clutter to work well. Some people do not care either way. Whether the area is cluttered or clear, they work the same. And for others, it may depend on the project. For administrative work, they might need a clear workspace. But for more creative projects, they may need many things around them. Like Kastner said earlier, it is complex. However, on one thing, she is very clear. One way is not better than another. People need to be able to design their workspaces, she says, in a way that works best for them.
But again, I think it's important to take this all into consideration when you create workspaces, because you need to give people, I think, the individual choices, whatever serves them best.
To know how your brain reacts to clutter, Kastner says you need to take an honest look at your home and work environments. What is working and what is not? If your home or office is cluttered and you cannot find anything, you may need more organizing. However, if your house or office is cluttered, but you can find everything you need, then perhaps your brain works fine around clutter. Kastner gives this warning. Do not continue doing something that is not working for you. She has another warning. We should not blame clutter for all of our stress and lack of productivity. There could be many issues involved in both. Now, if you're wondering which way Kastner prefers, she likes clutter, both at home and at work. In fact, she says she feels sad if her workspace is too clean.
But I know a lot of people who really need clear workspaces. Those would be spaces that would depress me. I would never excel in spaces like that. But I know that there are people who really excel in these spaces. So they are just different from me, and I think that's great and that's wonderful.
Kastner says our brains are all so different, and that is what makes us who we are. And that's the Health and Lifestyle Report. I'm Ana Mateo.
People may have questions about the new coronavirus. Can it survive in cold weather? Can the virus be spread by mosquito bites? Is there a vaccine or medication that prevents it? Is there any medicine that cures it? The answer to all of these questions is no. But there are ways to protect yourself. Wash your hands. Cover your cough. Stay at home if you are sick or advised by local authorities. For more information, visit the following websites: the World Health Organization at www.who.int or the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention at www.cdc.gov.
Today on our National Parks Journey, we head to the far western part of Texas. The landscape here is severe. The Chisos Mountains rise from the desert. The Rio Grande River cuts deep into ancient limestone rock. cactus plants flower under the intense sun. Welcome to Big Bend National Park. At first sight, Big Bend seems empty of life, but the park is home to many plants and animals. Over 450 kinds of birds can be found within the park, along with 75 mammal species and more than 50 kinds of reptiles. The park's diversity comes from its three different ecosystems. Within the park are mountain, desert, and river environments.
The Rio Grande sustains the park. The river starts high up in the Rocky Mountains. Melting mountain snow is its main source. It travels more than 3,000 kilometers on its way to the Gulf of Mexico. The river cuts through the dry Chihuahuan Desert. Big Bend National Park contains the northernmost part of this desert. It is the second largest desert in North America. Much of the desert is south of the border in Mexico. The Rio Grande serves as an international border between the United States and Mexico for about 1,600 kilometers. The park itself shares a border with Mexico for 189 kilometers. The Chihuahuan Desert is the largest ecosystem in the park. 80% of the park is desert. Animals like jackrabbits, roadrunner birds, and mule deer live in the Chihuahuan. Many cactus and yucca species thrive. These are succulent plants. Most succulents have thick, heavy leaves that store water. Cacti store water in their stems.
High up in the park's Chisos Mountains, you will find fir and pine trees, aspens and maples. Temperatures here are much cooler than down on the desert floor. The entire Chisos Mountain range exists within Big Bend. It is the only mountain range in the United States that is fully within a national park. Its highest mountains, Emery Peak and Lost Mine Peak, each rise more than 2,000 meters above the hot desert floor. The woodland environment in the mountains is home to black bears, mountain lions, and gray foxes. It is also home to many kinds of birds. Visitors are drawn to the park because of its rare and unique bird species. One of these is the Colima warbler. These small gray, yellow, and red birds arrive at Big Bend in the springtime to mate and nest. Then they return south to Mexico. In the late summer, mountain sage flowers appear. Hummingbirds, blue-throated, ruby-throated, magnificent, and Lucifer seek out these flowers.
Along with its plant and animal life, the park is also rich in cultural history. Archaeological records of humans in the area go back about 10,000 years, beginning with the prehistoric Paleo-Indians. Later on, the Chisos Indians lived here, as did the Comanche and Jumano people and other native groups. Spanish explorers began to arrive in the area in the 1500s. They were searching for gold and fertile land. They described this land as despoblado, or uninhabited. Much of what is now Big Bend National Park was Mexican territory until 1848. Mexican settlers farmed and raised animals here. In the early 1900s, many Anglo-Americans began settling in the area.
Big Bend became a national park on June 12, 1944. It covers more than 320,000 hectares. President Franklin D. Roosevelt established the park just 1 week after D-Day. That is the day American and British troops invaded Normandy, France. As America's attention centered on World War II, Roosevelt established a new national park for future generations to enjoy. For several years before the park was created, hundreds of men worked to build roads and trails to prepare the area for visitors. They built the 11-kilometer road that leads to the Chisos Mountains Basin. A basin is a large area of the Earth's surface that is lower than the area surrounding it. Today, the basin is a popular place within the park. Visitors can stay in the Chisos Mountain Lodge there or at campgrounds. Many of the park's hiking trails begin near the basin. One of the most popular is the Lost Mine Trail. It starts near the Chisos Mountain Lodge. The trail goes up sharply through forests of pine, juniper, and oak trees. The 8-kilometer-long hike passes by lookout points for viewing Casa Grande Peak, one of Texas's major mountains. Hikers can also enjoy a view into the park's Juniper Canyon.
More than 300,000 people visit Big Bend each year. Most come between November and April, when the weather is cooler. A favorite way to explore the park is by boat on the Rio Grande. Many tour operators organize rafting trips. Rafting trips take you through many kilometers of beautiful deep canyons. They may last half a day or several days. On longer trips, travelers sleep next to the river in tents. Another way to enjoy the Rio Grande is in its many hot springs. These are places where hot water flows up from underground. The water temperature is over 40 degrees Celsius. The river's hot springs are said to have healing properties. They hold mineral salts from the earth. Big Bend National Park has offered beauty, excitement, and recreational challenge to visitors for more than 80 years. It is a true treasure of Texas and the larger United States. I'm Katie Weaver.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.